And this is soup? What kind of soup?
Miso.
Ah, miso. Are we recording now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'll delete everything you're on.
No, you don't have to delete a thing. For the record, my name is Michael Dodge, D-O-D-G-E, and I've been asked to talk about an interesting negotiation. Interesting to whom, I'm not sure. I guess that means interesting to me, so I'll tell you one interesting to me. I guess you need a little bit of background here, and Samir has some of it. You just heard a bit of it. Prior to my becoming a lawyer, or even going to law school, I was a seaman. I was a sailor on square rigged ships. Do you know what that is? A square rigged ship?
No idea.
Cutty Sark. You know that kind of a ship? If I say Cutty Sark. Mm-hmm. Square sails, like a pirate ship. Think of a pirate ship. Treasure Island.
I was thinking of the booze and the picture of the ship on there. Yeah. And the alcoholic beverage.
Well, that's what they call them, tall ships here in the United States. Tall ships, you'll hear them called. People who actually do it refer to them as square rig ships because the rig is traditional square rig ship. So at any rate, I did that as a first officer for about 10 years on sail training vessels in Europe. And I'd been on a ship called Phoenix, a brigantine, a Class A square rigger, a big one. And I'd been on her for a couple years as first officer, training cadets, and then I got off. And the ship was
and the ship was
sold. Actually went into decline for about a year or so forth. Didn't hear anything about her. And then out of the blue, I got a call. I was actually back in the United States, and I got a call from Europe from some ship owners who had just bought this ship. And they bought it kind of as a hulk. You know, the whole rig was down. All the masts were down. All the yards were down. All the rigging was in a heap. There were over about 200 lines of running rigging, put sails up and down. About 180 lines of standing rigging. You had almost 500 lines. None of them labeled, all of them in a heap on the dock.
Great.
So these guys bought the ship very cheaply, thinking that, they just would put the rig up. Then they started talking to shipyards and found out that was going to cost $350,000 to get the ship rigged.
It's not that bad.
So they went into the ship's books, and they saw that I was been the first officer on board for years. Thank you very much. Saw in the ship's logs that I had rigged this ship myself twice before. And called me up and said, would I come over and rig it again? Put the rig up for him. We had negotiations for about a week. And we agreed that I would come with a dozen riggers, a dozen guys who knew their onions. This is my little brother, friends from high school, friends, but all sailors, all seamen, and a bunch of square rig guys that I'd been sailing with in Europe. And the deal was, they pay all our plane fares, they pay all of our expenses, everything. We rig the ship for them. They pay the entry fees into the tall ships race for that year, 3 months in the summer. And we would get the exclusive use of the ship for the entire race, from the start of the race to 1 week after the closing ceremonies. It was all written up in a contract.
So you race boats?
Pardon?
You race boats regularly?
Every 2 years there's a tall ships race, and all the big square riggers from all over the world get together. There were over 300 of them in this one in Göteborg, Sweden. But we then all flew over and started to work at a feverish rate, because the tall ships race started in about 2 months. And we had an enormous amount of work to get done in 2 months to be able to race the ship. We worked 48 straight days without a break. No days off, every day the same, 48 straight days, and it rained every day.
So sounds miserable.
Springtime in Holland. We got all done on the exact drop-dead day. We did this work in a little town called Helvetschlaus on the Dutch coast. But the tall ships race started in Göteborg, Sweden. You know, 600 miles away. And we had to sail around Denmark to get there. So we had to leave by a certain date, and we left on exactly that day. No spare time. We got into Göteborg, and it was the biggest party in the world. 5 million people, they say, were there to see these ships. The place was jammed. And almost all of these ships, and certainly every Class A ship, every single one of them. Hello.
That's Sarah. Nice to meet you.
Michael.
Sorry
nice to meet you.
Late.
No, no worries. We're sorry we started without you.
Oh, that's okay. No, I'm good. No, I'm okay. Yeah. Continue.
Continue or?
Huh?
How's the hello?
It was okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry what these troubles everybody's having here. That's terrible.
Yeah.
Do they know what happened?
I don't know. I don't think the police have, like, closed the case yet.
I read on the paper that they said they're ruling it right now as strictly an accident.
Oh, are they? Okay.
That was yesterday's paper.
Okay.
I don't know what's developed since.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, from what the papers are saying, he was at the game or something, and he was hiding underneath the bus, and nobody knows why. And he got dragged, I don't know how far, but
a quarter of a mile.
And then the body was found, you know, on a corner street.
What was he doing underneath the bus?
That's what nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Too,
I've been reading online some of the people commenting on this stuff. There's no answers. It's completely just people just that have no part or whatever. They're like, oh, he's such an idiot, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Like, I was talking to one of my friends heard about this too, and I was like, you know, it doesn't matter. I don't know what kind of big, stupid mistake you do. You don't deserve to die because of that, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Awesome. So, what we're talking about right now is these, I guess this is kind of like a pirate situation that I haven't heard the pirate story yet.
Okay.
But so far, his story has been that he used to help like rig ships, and then somehow he got contracted for this job. And he rigged up the ship, and they're taking to this race. They were in Holland. He said they're going to Sweden for this race. So, is that all right?
Are you going to order something?
No, I'm good actually. I was hungry at 5.
Oh.
I'm an early eater.
So, anyways, that's where we are at in the story right now. This is just sort of actually some background information to get to the real part of where the real negotiations are.
Okay.
I don't even know where to begin now. I've been telling this. I started in class and then went here.
You just got to the point where you got to the start of the race. Big party.
So we had done all this work. Work that was the equivalent of about, well, the bid from the Dutch shipyard had been $350,000 to rig this ship. We're talking about square rig ships. Do you know what those are? Do you know what a tall ship is?
Are these sailing boats? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you know what a pirate ship is? You know what I mean by a pirate ship? Square sails.
Okay.
Old-fashioned from, you know, 1700s. HMS Bounty, right? Bounty, you know, all those ones with square sails. The big old clipper ships.
Okay.
Right? They're called square rig ships or sail training vessels, and in the United States they call them tall ships. But this is the ship we rigged. We rigged one of these, and it's in a basically an authentic 1850 brigantine, and this ship was called Brigantine Phoenix. And a bunch of my buddies, I was called and asked to rig one of these things. It was going to be $350,000 for a shipyard to do it. I had been the first officer of the ship for 2 years before. The owners couldn't afford the $350. They looked in the logbooks and said, hey, this guy's done it twice before on the ship. You know, let's find him. So they found me in the States. I flew over. We worked like dogs for a couple of months, got all the ship rigged. The deal was we get to use...
That water for you. Here's the orange sauce roll.
Oh, orange sauce.
And then here's your avocado cucumber, devil, timber cali, and green dragon.
That's a little there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah? Okay.
So after all this work, we get to Uteborg. And it's the biggest party on earth, and all my friends are there. I've been doing it for years, so I'm just having a great time seeing all my old buddies. And what happened is that it was on the second night after we got there, and just before the race was going to start, that all of a sudden I was on the ship Danmark, a military ship, the Danish military ship, a huge square rigger. They train naval cadets on board, and with one of my buddies. And my little brother came running to the gangplank shouting for me. I had to get to the ship right away. Got to the ship. This was probably about midnight. And what had happened is that the captain of the ship, my friend, the guy I hired to do it basically, a guy named, you need a special license to do this. And one of my best friends was a guy named Captain Mike Wheeler, a British square rig captain. And he was gone. He's one of my best friends. He's not on the ship. And I get to the ship and there's a stranger sitting down in the main salon, some guy I've never seen before, some guy 40 years old, something like that, sitting down there. I've never seen the guy in my life. And what I'm informed is that the owners have fired Michael Wheeler, the captain. And they've hired this new captain, this guy. And then we have a choice. The deal was we get to have the exclusive use of this ship for 3 months. To do this whole tall ships race. The race is going to go from Uteborg to Copenhagen to Oslo, Norway, and then to Amsterdam with closing ceremonies in Amsterdam. It's going to take about 3 months to do that. So we're about the next day to start the adventure of a lifetime, right? For most of these guys, sailing one of these ships all through the Baltic and the North Sea. And here's this guy sitting in the main saloon at midnight. The owners have fired Mike Wheeler and they've hired him to be captain. And the deal that we are offered now is we get to sail anywhere we want for 2 weeks. Not 3 months. 2 weeks. Wherever it is we end up, 2 weeks later we get off, then boom. And it's done. That's it. Take it or leave it. If you refuse, get off now. They'll call the police. So this is really horrible. We just worked 2 months in the rain. These were 16-hour days we were working. We found ourselves working in the rain at 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the morning, pitch black, to get this ship ready for this. I think this is it. To get this ship ready for this race. And now it's all over. So what do you do? What would you do?
I'm not sure.
Did you have a signed contract?
Yep, we did.
Oh,
yeah. Signed contract with everything all there. No question about it.
You called the owner.
The owner sent this guy. And the owners are in Holland. We're in Uteborg, Sweden. So what do you do? Well, Samir knows. What we did was, this is about, by this time now, it's about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I gave the order, actually. But I had the crew pick this guy up, and walk him off the ship, and we tied him up to a lamppost. Poured liquor all over him. Made him seem like he reeked of alcohol, so we figured anybody, cops or anything else, would think the guy was drunk because he was just reeking with alcohol. He'd be raving about some guys that stole a ship, but people would take a minute to realize that he wasn't drunk. And we took the ship. We took it. Sailed away. Right then. And this created an international incident where the navies of Well, I know for sure Denmark, Germany, and Sweden were searching the Baltic for days, searching for this ship. The Navy, they sent out the navies to search for it. It was a big deal. Front page in all the newspapers, because this big, tall ship's race is going on, millions of people interested, right? And here, right in the midst, a Class A square rigger is stolen by Americans, right off the dock, sailed away. Nobody knows where it is, and this is in the Baltic. That's like a big lake, the Baltic, right?
We have this table over here for 14. You guys want to move over there?
I know it's working enough.
We then sailed for the next 2 days, and we're hearing all the radio traffic. We're hearing the radio. You're searching everywhere. But because Mike Wheeler was English, they thought we came out of Uteborg and headed west. They thought we were trying to go to London, to England. We went in the opposite direction. We headed due south out of Uteborg. We were sailing around Sweden to go to Stockholm, where we intended to exert a maritime lien for our wages on the ship. That's a legal action where all you have to do is go into the maritime courts and represent we haven't been paid. Swedish government then contacts the owners and says, have you paid them? And unless they can prove payment, the owners have 10 days to pay the crew, and after 10 days, the Swedish government seizes the ship and sells it at open auction within a week. It happens like lightning. There's no time at all. It's just like lightning. That's because the crews of these ships are invariably from some other country. They don't know anybody in Sweden. They're stuck there. They don't have any place to stay, right? So they want this to be expedited. The owners have to pay.
The money right away.
Yeah, the owners pony up right away because otherwise their ship will be sold. So you can end up with a $10 million ship, right? If you haven't paid the crew, they'll sell it on the spot, and they'll sell it for $1 million. The government doesn't care.
Do you get that $1 million, or does the government keep it?
No. What the government does is the government pays off the crew the amount that's determined to be their wages, and anything over that goes to the owners. But their ship is gone, and somebody got a $10 million ship for $1 million.
Yeah.
So that's what we were trying to do. Meanwhile, the owners charged us officially with piracy. There are all kinds of other charges, conspiracy to commit murder, kidnapping, and some weird one for stealing something that costs more than $100,000 or something like that.
Grand theft.
We knew they were after us because we could hear it on the radio. And on the third day, we came upon this little island in the Baltic called Grönhögen. And I'd been there years before and watched the Swedish government dredgers dredge out the harbor. Now, the sea charts, you read a sea chart, Class A square rigger can't go in there. It's too shallow. But I knew we could go in there because I'd seen them dredge it out. So anybody trying to find us would look at Grönhögen, look at a chart and go, nope, they can't be there, right, and move on. Well, that's where we went. And we were having a, because we knew we weren't going to make it. At that point then, we knew that they had, the search was now starting to go in the other direction. They couldn't find us heading to England. Now they were coming back into the Baltic and thought we were hiding something. We heard all this.
Mm-hmm. It's not a volcano. You know, never mind.
Is that enough?
I ordered some pickles. Because you guys ordered a double roll. This is a double roll.
What are they? Just for...
This is California. This is the dragon.
What's the dragon? Oh, is that the eel?
That's it. Try them both. They're both good. This one's a little bit of a fried outside. It's got shrimp in it. Feel free to ask.
This one is? No, that one is. Is that a shrimp tempura?
It's California tempura.
So that's got crab in it then, too?
I
this one has...
I think it does. It looks like it does.
Yeah, that's crab. This one has shrimp and crab in it. That's crab.
California has...
That was just crap.
Is it?
I mean, how could be wrong?
I don't know.
This one, Orange Crush, it's got salmon, cream cheese, and this stuff on the top. It's just good.
It's got roe on it.
Mm-hmm. Fish eggs.
Yeah.
So what happened is that we were having a barbecue on Groenhogen, right on the shore. Knew we were in some kind of trouble, but we weren't sure what. We're pretty upset because the tall ships race has now started. That whole summer is blown. Our whole summer is blown. And about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, plane flew over. Plane went by this island. No plane should be flying over Groenhogen. Plane flew over, and I was up in the rig, and I saw it go by. And I said, well, maybe they saw us, maybe they didn't, but that plane is sure as hell looking for us. 5 minutes later, the plane came right by the ship about 100 feet off the ground. I was up at the mast. It went right by at eye level. I was 100 feet up, and it went right by right there. I was looking right at the pilot. Right by. He's looking right at me. And I yelled down, they got us. They found us. About 3 hours later, all hell broke loose. I mean, every Navy you can think of anchored some big ship right off this island. They couldn't come in. They all anchored off. And there's a ferry from the mainland to Groenhogen. Next thing we know, there's 50 policemen. They brought a bus. They carried over a bus to take us off. And I actually saw the inside of it. There were handcuffs. There was a metal rail, you know, like a metal handrail in front of every seat. Yeah, but on these handrails were metal handcuffs. So they were going to take us away. And my picture was on the front page of the newspaper that day with this whole story about how we'd been cheated and everything else by the owners. Swedish newspaper. So as they're arresting me, I got this newspaper with the headlines with my picture on it. I'm holding it for the cops going, we're not the bad guys, they are. Right? We didn't steal this ship. We got nothing else to do. This is where we're living. We built it, right? We built it. We can document it. And we're going to Stockholm to exert a maritime lien. So the police didn't know what to do. And there was this big, they were on telephones all the time. This was before cell phones. So what they did was they locked us all on the ship. Or rather said, everybody on the ship, get on the ship and don't step off. And they put guards on the ship. So we're on the ship, you can't get off. The owners had made all these very serious criminal charges. Swedish police contacted them and said, we're starting to think this isn't a criminal matter, this is a civil matter. You get here now.
Another lemonade that has everything tasty.
Right. You get here now or we're going to let them go. So the owners flew in on a private plane that landed right there in the harbor. That's late that night. They flew in from Amsterdam. Police were all there. It was a nightmare. All these people. The news media showed up, too. So it was quite a circus. And what the police said was, you guys have 48 hours to work this out. After 48 hours, we're going to escort the ship and the crew to Stockholm to have this go to trial. I'm just taking them. Sorry. Oh, geez, I hit too many. And have a trial. So the owners fly in. They say, work it out. We have 2 days. So for the next 2 days, sitting in an open field under a goofy umbrella, I sat by myself with these two Dutch owners. They're two of the richest guys in Holland. Kees Tijnenberg and Herr Kramer Freer. And we negotiated out a settlement. And they ended up paying us about $100,000. Just under $100,000. And divvied up, according to everybody's experience in their rank on board the ship. So I was, I was first officer. I got $15,000 in cash. That's what I got, $15,000. And we all left, and we had all worked out, and we all left the ship. Now, I told that story in class tonight with a little bit more details, right?
Yeah.
Longer version of it. Because even though this looked like it was a successful negotiation, it really wasn't. What happened is the reason these guys reneged on us, the reason they created this whole thing is they didn't know anything about square rig ships. These were two yachtsmen. These were two rich yachtsmen, right? and like it owns 50-foot racing yachts, right? And they're going to buy a 130-foot square rig Class A ship made out of wood, you know, that's 70 years old, made out of wood. And they think they're going to just sail it like something else? No. They didn't know what they were getting into. But also they didn't know, after the ship was all rigged, of course, and just as we were leaving Holland, they had all their friends come, all their yachting friends. They had this big celebration with champagne, and they had all these guys in ties and everything else come to see their very cool square rig ship before it left. So the friends all took one look at this and said, my God, you guys know what you got. The Class A square rig ship charters out for $50,000 a week during tall ships races. $50,000 a week. We had it for 3 months, right? Right? $500,000 is what that would charter out for, that kind of money. And then they also found out is because this all happened in Holland, and Brigantine Phoenix was the only Class A square rigger in the race that was Dutch registered, that at the closing ceremonies in Holland, that the Queen of Holland would actually be on board Phoenix, right? As the host ship. So they had to get these American bums off somehow, and they had all this money and all these parties and all this stuff, and they figured they were just going to throw the Americans off. What are they going to do? Right? What are they going to do? So in this sort of arrogance of, you know, what are these kids going to do, right? So these guys were in their late 40s, 50s, right? When this all happened, this happened years ago. I must have been 28 or 29. I've been doing it for years at that point, so I was probably, maybe I was 30. But I was basically a bum, right? I mean, I was a ship's officer. I was a, you know what I mean? On land, we all look like bums. Now, at sea, we're no bums, right? At sea, but they just thought they could do whatever they wanted with us. So there's certain arrogance. Then I told Samir what happened at the end. We negotiated everything out. It was very amicable at the end once we came to terms. They were immediately flipped to being very friendly. And in particular, I had bought all the sea charts on the ship. I had charted out. All the charts were gone. And I bought all the sea charts for the entire tall ships race. And I think it was probably around $500 of my own money that I spent to chart out the whole race and have my own charts. These are all on board, and I'm not going to get to take them. Do you know what I mean? These are the only charts on board. There's no judge. Nobody's ever going to allow you to take all the sea charts off a ship in the middle of an island of the Baltic. That's not going to happen. But I said to the owner, I said, you know, right when at the end of the negotiation, I got it as a nibble, right, at the end. By right on the edge saying, you know, the only thing that troubles me now is those are all my charts. I paid for them. I have the bill. I paid personally. Right? And what they did was they let me pick whatever sea charts I wanted to take, and I left them some and they paid me for them. So it was all very amicable at the end. And they were all happy and saying, oh, you know, everything was all great. And I got right on another square rig ship owned by a friend of mine called Betsetta, came and got us and took us all to Stockholm. We had a great time in Stockholm for a couple of weeks. Then we bummed around Europe for the summer because we had all this money now, right? So we had ended up having a fine time.
But you said it was $50,000. A week, or is that a day for the tall rigs race?
$50,000 a week would be the charter value, $500,000. Right. So that's what they wanted out of the deal. That's why they created this whole thing.
Did they miss the whole race then, or were they able to put it to use? Like, did they get anything out of it, or did they just made everybody lose in this case?
It's getting, there's a lot more.
There's a lot more. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's the beginning.
Oh, okay.
That's what you needed to hear, the beginning of the story. So what happens then, I came back and all the crew were basically locked up on ship. Not locked up, but we call it lockdown. If you can't leave the ship, you're locked down on a ship. So I came back and told everybody, you know, what the offer was and that I had accepted it. And everybody, I got this huge stack of cash. They brought this cash in this big bag, right? And it was all this cash. It's $100,000 in cash, basically. And we took everything they had. That was the other thing. And what finally did it was they finally said, here's the bag of money we got. We had to come here in 4 hours, right? I mean, we got this call from the Stockholm authorities. And we had to grab whatever cash we could, right? And we got it, and this is it, and that's all we're going to talk about. So we got all of that cash. Now, they hired a new crew. They were flying in this whole new crew of guys that were going to take over for us. And we stayed until the day the crew was arriving, but they didn't want the crews to intermingle at all, so we didn't see them all. They see them at all. We got off and we sailed away. New crew came on, and they're going to take it to Amsterdam and start selling tickets, start making money, start having parties, right? No. We had these 200-pound, maybe, I think what they were weren't 200, they were 100-kilo sacks. Remember in class I was saying I didn't know they were like 200 pounds or 300 pounds? It was 100 kilos.
Okay.
Sacks of rice on board. And unbeknownst to me, as we were leaving at the end, what the crew did was they cut the sacks of rice open and let the rice go into the bilges. Now all the seawater that comes in, these are old wooden ships, they've taken on water all the time. You're running the pumps every day to get the water out of the hull. You put rice in there, the rice, it soaks up the water. It won't go through the pumps, right? The more water that comes in, you just get heavier rice. So the ship starts sinking lower and lower in the water, right? And you can't pump anything out. Nothing pumps, right? But that's not the worst part. The worst thing they did was they also cut all the headlines. You know what a head is on a ship? That's a toilet. There were four toilets on this ship. All had piping that went underneath down into the bilges. This PVC pipe. They got in there and they cut out sections. They cut out sections with a hacksaw of PVC pipe so it couldn't be repaired, right? They cut the sections out and took them away, right? They didn't just punch a hole in them, which could be taped up. Or no, they cut out, it was PVC pipe, they cut it out with a hacksaw and threw these big chunks out over the side. And unbeknownst to everybody in the crew, this is a big ship, they didn't know for days. But every single time anybody flushed a toilet, all that went directly into the bottom of the ship to mix up with rice. This is summertime. The ship was 130 feet long. Unbelievable. Unbearable. Can't live on it. You can't go below. You can't go below in the decks. You can't do anything. And the other thing you can't do is you can't clean it. I mean, I don't even know how you clean something like that. Because it all soaks up. This is all oak. The ship was oak. It soaks all that stuff in. Well, they got as far, they got about a couple hundred miles. They got to Kiel, Germany. And the entire crew pulled in the Kiel, which they weren't heading to anyway. Pulled in the keel, and they all walked off instantly and would never set foot on it again. The ship sat there for the next 6-7 months and didn't move because of this whole thing.
Should have just paid the $350
at the beginning. So they got nothing. What happened next is the story. That's the prologue. This is the part you haven't heard. Part two. I bummed around Europe that summer with my little brother and my buddies and did some races, had a good time. Came back to the States in late summer, and I think it was in September, October, middle of the night, I got a telephone call from Freddie Charles, a wonderful woman, Freddie Charles. She had been the owner of Brigantine Phoenix. When I sailed for her for 2 years as first officer. When she
previous
was
owner.
She's the previous owner before the bad guys got it. Freddie sold it because she couldn't afford it anymore. It cost about, back then, this is 20 years ago, it cost $50,000 a year just to keep the thing in the water. Without doing anything else to it, just to keep it, not to fix it up, not just $50,000 just to let it sit someplace. And Doesn't sound like much now, but back then that was a lot of money. Keep a ship in the water. And so she had sold it to these bad guys, Case Steinberg and Herr Kramer Frere, the two Dutch guys. Freddie was Dutch though too. She was also from Amsterdam, actually Rotterdam. But at any rate, I've been back. This whole thing has been over for 4 months. I get a call from Freddie Charles in the middle of the night about Phoenix, the same goofy ship. She's the one that tells me that the thing got as far as Kiel, and then all hell broke loose because she said the bloody thing was filled with shit, and they couldn't get it out. Nobody would work on it. And what happened is the Dutch owners just let it sit there. They were just like fed up with the whole thing, right? Didn't know what to do. Didn't know. They got a ship stuck in Germany. It just turned into a nightmare for them. And at the same time, something else happened. Well, I'll get to that. At any rate, what Freddie Charles was calling me about was she had just heard that there was an auction, that a bank in Rotterdam was auctioning off Brigantine Phoenix for sale. And that the high bid for the ship was $35,000. This is for a ship worth $500,000.
Even with all the stuff in it, with all the sewage and rice?
It had been cleaned at this point now. This was now, actually, when I think about it, this wasn't right after, it was almost a year had gone by when I got the call. It wasn't that fall right after the summer. A year goes by and I don't hear anything.
Okay.
Sorry, yeah, it was a year. And what's happened is that the owners had defaulted on loans, and that they had put the ship up as collateral on the loans, and it had been seized by the bank. And the bank was auctioning it off. And they'd held an auction for it, and Freddie Charles told me that the high bid was $35,000 and that there were no more bids, and the bank had pulled it, terminated the auction. They weren't going to sell it for that. They just terminated it. And that if I wanted to buy the ship, I should come over right away and get it. Now, Freddie always knew I had an interest in buying the ship. And in fact, at one point years before, I'd made her an offer for it, right? That she didn't take because she loved it. But I'd made her an offer for it. And so she now hears this for sale. She and I were good pals, knew each other for years. She calls me up. Maybe you can get it from the bank, right? She called me in the middle of the night. The next day, I flew to London. Picked up Mike Wheeler in Sussex. And that next morning early, Mike Wheeler and I flew to Rotterdam. And I had $280,000. I came with $280,000. I came with a banking instructions so I could draw up to $280,000 to bid on a ship. And this was all within a day of the call. Freddie Charles called me at 2 o'clock in the morning. I was on a flight at 4 o'clock the next day with the $280,000. All arranged, picked up Wheeler in London. We flew to Rotterdam, and we're going to bid, right? We're going to buy the ship from the bank. So we go straight to the bank, and that's when the whole thing started. I don't know how much detail I should tell you. I'm going to try to eat this thing, so take a break for a minute.
That's fun.
Had not been in law school. I was 30, but I'd just been a sailor my whole life.
Okay.
So we get to Holland. I got a big bag of money. We start negotiations with the bank. Right off the bat, we knew something was weird. Something was odd. Because when we tried to schedule a meeting with the bank, we called the bank and said we'd like to talk to somebody who's in charge of Brigantine Phoenix, the disposition of Brigantine Phoenix. Oh yeah, here's this guy. We called his secretary. Said we were in to discuss the potential sale of Brigantine Phoenix. Dead silence. I was on the phone. I remember. Dead silence. She said, where can you be reached? This whole kind of secret thing started right then. And they scheduled a meeting for us at 9 o'clock at night at the bank. 9 o'clock at night. The bank's all closed. The whole financial district, right downtown Rotterdam, the whole financial district was all blacked out. I mean, everything was closed. It's all banks. It's like Wall Street at 9 o'clock at night. It's dark. Nothing's open. Everything's locked up. Furthermore, we were instructed not to go to the front door. We're supposed to go to a weird side door that's almost an entire city block away from the entrance to this place. I mean, weird. Just a complete nondescript door with no sign or anything on it. So complicated instructions as to what door to go to. All very weird. And it's pitch
sounds
dark.
Like they're trying to
it's like,
you.
It's like James Bond. It's like a setup or something. So we get there and we find out it's all legitimate. Here's this banker. He's all done up, all right? I mean, I'm in blue jeans. He's all done up to the nines. He's got, thank you very much for coming. We're sorry for all this strange stuff and everything. And we sit down and it all gets very weird at this point now, because now the story starts to come out. The banker pulled open this weird big portfolio thing that had newspaper clippings in it. And it was all the newspaper clippings dating back to me and my guys and the charge of piracy back a year, 14 months before, all pasted in this book by the bank. And what happened is that what we find out is that this whole story of what happened to us in the Baltic with the Americans and the Dutch ship, right? Remember I told you I was on the front page of the Swedish newspaper, right? And all this stuff was going on all in Sweden, right? Well, we didn't know that this was all on front page stuff in Holland as well, right? This was the Dutch Class A square rig ship for the tall ships race. It's the only Class A Dutch ship there. And when this whole thing blew up with piracy, for God's sakes, this was all over the news. And what happened is it focused scrutiny on these two owners, Kramer Frere and Case Steinenberg. And what happened is that it started to get very ugly. Because what it turned out is they had bought the ship with black money and financed all of the repairs and our fees and everything with black money. Black money is the illegal money in Holland on which no taxes have been paid at all. That you get, you know, so if you're in the drug trade, you got a lot of cash. What do you do with it? You can't declare taxes on it. These two guys have been skimming money out of their companies and putting it into this square rig ship as a really good place to launder money. The newspaper did it. One of the big newspapers there did an in-depth investigation, had it on the front page for months. These two guys got indicted for fraud and theft and income tax evasion and all this stuff. And Case Steinenberg was actually convicted and sent to a work camp where he had to work in the woods for 9 months. This is a 58-year-old guy, one of the richest guys in Holland. And he lost his job. He lost his new house. His wife divorced him, right? And he ended up in a work camp in the woods in Holland for 9 months. Herr Kramer Frere, the other owner, who was really a son of a bitch, fled Holland. He owned the largest stainless steel fabricating company in all of Holland, and he walked away from it and left and moved to Spain rather than go to prison. It turned out to be a huge stinking Holland. We knew none of this. We were oblivious to this whole thing. The bank hadn't seized Phoenix for non-payment of a note. These guys were up to their butts in cash. The government had seized it because it was all black money. The government had seized it, and the bank ended up with it. So now here this ship is being sold, and this ship's worth $500,000, and the high bid is $35,000. What happened? What went wrong with the first auction? And that's when we found out. Now, the banker didn't tell me this. Freddie Charles told me. She had found out. The reason that the high bid was only $35,000 at the auction is because everybody that put their hand up to bid at the auction, within 1 minute, a huge guy would get out of a seat in the back of the room walk over and whisper to him, and he would not bid again. And what happened with the $35,000 bid, there had been a bid of $50,000 who was visited by a whisper 5 seconds later. And the guy actually stood up and said, I withdraw my bid, and turned around and walked out.
The bank represented the government to...
Pardon?
The bank represented the government to make that bid for him.
What this was were steel workers at a Kramer Fair stainless steel plant. He owned this big stainless steel fabricating plant. He's got all these hard guy steel workers. He had them show up to the auction. He's from Spain somehow trying to keep this ship. Somehow trying to salvage something. And he wants the ship. And he's pissed off that they seized this ship. So he's trying to do whatever he can to let anybody know, anybody buys this, he's got problems. The guy's basically a gangster. He's a bad guy. What we found out next, and we find this out then, Freddie Charles didn't know this, but we found out when I confronted the bankers with some of this, I understand that there were physical threats of violence at the auction, and the banker said, well, yes, that's perhaps true. And that's why it didn't sell. Well, yes, perhaps that's true. Then we get into... Then he opened this guy, banker owned up. This is about the third time we met with him. Then he opens up and shows us more pages in this book. And what it turns out is the name Papa Blanca is highlighted in all these articles about the ship. I've never heard of anybody called Papa Blanca. Never heard of the guy. Turns out that Papa Blanca is the number one organized crime guy in Holland. Number one. The worst son of a bitch in Holland. And that's saying something, because this is a country made up of son-of-a-bitches, okay? Papa Blanca, bad guy gangster. It turns out that Papa Blanca had been involved in this money laundering scheme with these two guys, and that Papa Blanca has an interest in the ship. But he can't declare it or stand up and get it, because he's not on any of the papers, and they'll know, well, where'd you get the money to get this ship, right? It got him to be a circular thing. And nobody could stand up and say, I own a piece of this ship, and I got $200,000 of my money into it, right? But his name's all through the articles with this. There's actually one reporter in Rotterdam, that was on this Papa Blanca story. So now this thing is all tangled up. I'm just trying to buy a square rig ship, right? That's all. But it's now tangled up with organized crime, all kinds of fraud, black money, two guys that were indicted, one in jail, one's fled the country. And we find out that the reason, the other weird thing is, you know, we're having these meetings, you know, I kept meeting with the bankers over and over again. These meetings went on and on and on, these negotiations. But I was never at the bank during the day when they were open. These are all taking place at night. I'm coming in these weird entrances. And you know how I'm being taken out of the bank? This guy in the suit, we take an elevator down into the sub-basement. And we would walk almost a city block underground through the steam pipes. We would walk over to a metal platform and stand on it, and he would push a button. And then we would come up in an alley about a block away from the entrance of the bank, come right up out of the ground on the street with one of these hoop things that would hit these metal plates and the metal plates fly open, and we would come up in a black alley because the bank said the reason for all these precautions is that if they know that somebody's trying to buy this ship, their life is in danger, right? I mean, we've already had death threats, and so we're trying to keep this very hush-hush. So ostensibly that's why. So meanwhile, we're conducting our negotiations, and I made an offer. I ended up making an offer of $158,000 on the ship, and the bank was going to take it. $158,000. And we had a tentative deal, a handshake deal. I had hired a maritime lawyer in Holland to draw up the documents with the bank, to work with the bank. The bank was drawing up the documents, but I hired a maritime lawyer to work on the documents. We drew up sale documents for the ship. Mike Wheeler and I had a ball all one day because we went to the ship chandlers all over town. And, you know, I think I probably spent about $25,000 just at the ship chandlers, getting it, provisioning the ship. And what we were going to do is Mike Wheeler and I, just the two of us, were going to move the ship under power. We weren't going to set sails or do any of that stuff. We were going to just drive it like a motorboat, right? and just get it out of Holland. That's all we cared about. Get it out of Holland, get it out of these guys. So we went and spent a lot of money. I spent a lot of money buying all this stuff and had it all set to be delivered to the ship. And then we had this, we found out the name of this reporter who'd been writing all these stories, right? His name. And I called up the newspaper and asked to talk to this guy because I wanted more information, right, about what's not in these papers. What else can you tell me? How dangerous is this? And so we actually got to be sort of friends with this guy where we were, you know, at night after the bank, he wanted this whole story. He wanted all this stuff. So we'd come out of the bank, and we'd get out of the bank at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. We'd go to this guy's place and drink, right, and tell him what happens. He was sort of in on it. Couldn't write anything about it until after we were gone, but he knew all about it. And then one night we went there, and he told us that he had heard, we don't know how, that Mike Wheeler and I were going to be killed, right? That's what he heard at first, killed. And then he said, no, well, maybe that's not right. Not killed. What they're really told is to hurt you bad, hurt you so you at least have to be in the hospital a couple of months, right? And that what was going to happen to us is that somewhere around the bank at night, after one of these meetings, we'd be walking down the street, and he said, all of a sudden you're going to see two guys in front of you walking down the street coming at you. He said, you're not going to feel good about it at all when you see them. He said, when you see them, the first thing you'll do is turn around and look behind you, and when you look behind you, there'll be two guys behind you. He said, there are four of them. There's four of them going to come after you, and they're going to bust you up. Right? They're going to stop this thing right now. So that's what we heard. So the next thing was, well, what do we do? And the guy said, you leave the country. He said, you get out of here. Right? He said, they may not kill you. He said, you know, he said, in fact, we were pretty sure they weren't going to kill us, right? I mean, that's what they told us at first, that it was like death threats. But the more he was talking, he said, no, our understanding is they're just to put you in the hospital. So me being a good American, the first thing I said, well, I'm not leaving, right? You know, I'm not. He said, leave. You got to leave, right? I said, well, I'm not leaving. Well, what are you going to do?
Before we really got.
I want a gun. Want me to do the check today? You
want a gun.
Separate?
Yes.
All separate?
Yeah.
Okay. So you guys want me to split yours in half or by roll?
Just separate. I mean, I have two rolls.
Which ones?
California and the California couple of
What are we doing here?
I have the
splitting the check.
Oh, yeah. Here, just put it on there.
Are you sure?
Yeah, sure, thanks.
Thank you.
So, sure. Where was I? Oh, yeah, we're going to get busted up.
So you're getting your gun.
So I want a gun, right? And I told him, I made it pretty clear that, you know, I'm not going to shoot anybody. This was Holland, right? Nobody's got a gun. I mean, this is Europe. I did, and he wouldn't do it. But he said he would introduce me to somebody, and he did at a bar.
I love it.
And the whole deal was I had to promise not to shoot anybody, right? I had to absolutely promise not to shoot anybody. In fact, you know, I want to say that there were only three bullets. It wasn't even fully loaded. I do remember that it was a very cool gun. It was a Walther, a little automatic. You know, actually, it wasn't. PPK, I think the Walther PPK is the famous, that's the James Bond gun.
Yeah,
it wasn't a PPK, it was a Walther, but it was a different model. It was something I'd never heard of, right? But it was a very cool little pistol. It only had three bullets in it, right? But I was told, for God's sakes, don't shoot anybody. For God's sakes, don't kill anybody. All you have to do is show it, and he said, and people will flip out because nobody's got these, right? These guys are not coming after you with guns. They're going to come after you. You know, they're going to bust
pipes.
You up. With pipes, right? These are guys with pipes going to come after you, and they're going to bust you up, bust your legs, bust your hips, right? And so that actually happened. 2 days later, we came out of the bank, and there were two guys in front of us, and we turned around. We expected two guys behind us after this guy told us the story. It wasn't. It was one guy and a German Shepherd, which I thought to be a little bit odd. The guy brought his dog to a mugging, basically. And they're walking right at us, looking right at us, and there was no secret what they were doing. They were not shy boys. They were coming right at us, you know, with hard looks, and they absolutely meant serious business. And as they were coming, I still remember, I took out the gun, and showed it to him. I didn't point it at him. I took it out, and I remember I went like this, holding it like sideways, right? Like, look, and they stopped cold, right? And I turned around to the guy behind me, and I was holding it sideways is what I remember. I didn't have it like this. I said, look, I got a gun. And the guy behind me stopped dead too. And when I turned back, one of the guys in front of me started walking towards me, and I kind of went like this and just went bang right like that and started shaking my head with the gun pointed right at him. He froze, and they just disappeared. This is in the dark, and they just disappeared. They were gone. They went right back and were gone. We now know that this is a mess, and we got to get out of here, right? I mean, I've at this point now have bought all this stuff, right?
Did you buy the boat yet?
No, I haven't. We haven't signed the papers or turned over cash. The documents are being prepared. Thank you.
Are you still working on it?
Mr. Dodge?
Oh, never mind.
She was asking if you're all set. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Did I do the right one? I guess I did. Where was I? Oh, the gun. It was actually very cool because I had to give the guy a lot of money for the gun. We had a lot of money. I had to give him a lot of money for it. But then when I was done with it, and also the dust settled, I left Holland probably 4 days later. And I saw the guy, and I gave him back his gun, and he gave me all my money back but $100. So I rented the gun for $100 for 4 days, which I thought was great. Because what am I going to do with it? I can't travel with it. I can't do it. I was going to have to leave it. So I rented a gun for 4 days. The next thing we heard then is that the next meeting with the bankers, the documents are getting ready. And the bank now is starting to drag its heels a little bit. And they're starting to say, we have concerns here because now the bank has been threatened that the ship is going to be damaged so that it can't move. They've now been a threat that, you know, if you continue down this path, we'll sink the ship in our moorings, right? Women's now talking about sinking the ship. So now first they're going to attack us. That didn't work. Somebody went back and reported the son of a bitch has got a gun, right? Steel workers aren't going to do that, right? These guys are just workers, you know? And so what we had heard is that there's a couple ways to get the ship out of where she was. You know, Holland's all full of canals, right? Right? And the Zuider Zee and all these canals and everything all through the place. And there was a good way for us to get to where we wanted to go, and then we had to go through a lock, right? There's these locks. You know what I mean by a lock?
Yeah, the water goes up
and down. Water goes up and down. There's a lot of that there. And we had to go through a lock to get the ship out into open water. So we're now told, and it was actually the reporter who said this is what will happen, and I don't think he had any information. He just said, they're not going to let you out with a ship. Right. Either you're going to get busted up or the ship is going to get busted up, but they're trying to keep this thing here, right, for whatever reason. And they said it's because Papa Blanca said it's not to leave, right? And so we had to go through this lock. Well, when you're in a lock, that's about the worst place you can be. If you're in a lock, you can't move, right? And so we were told, you'll like this one, Samir. We were told that the lockmaster had been bribed to let us in and not let us out.
Oh.
Right? So what did we do?
Bribed the lockmaster to let you out.
That's right. That's just what we did. Now, did we go out that way?
No. You went a different way.
Why is that? Why would we bribe the guy?
So people think you're going that way.
And that's exactly what happened. We took the lockmaster a case of scotch. Said we're going to be coming through here between 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the morning, and we'd like you to be all ready and quick and get us out as quickly as you can. Here's a case of scotch. We knew he'd already been paid not to let us out. Now he's got confirmation we're coming through, and all the while we're going out through the herring fleet. There was another way for us to go out. It was called the herring fleet. And so we're going to swing around and go through the herring fleet, and we want them all waiting for us at the lock. We're going to be 15, 18 miles away, going out a completely different way. So what happened is that we bribed the lockmaster, and the next morning, actually, it was in the morning when we were going to do the deal and sign the papers. Was not at night. It was right in broad daylight. You know, it was all that kind of stuff. We had it all done up where we were going to buy the ship, transfer the funds, get all the documents. We're then going to go straight and pick up all the provisions. Remember, we bought all the stuff, but it was all still at the ship chandler's because we didn't have the ship yet. We didn't have any place to put it. So it was all being held for us, right? We hadn't paid yet either. Right, not in full. I put down, I think, a 20% deposit on all the stuff. Because we didn't know. I mean, I didn't have the ship yet, right? So at any rate, so what happens is all this stuff happened. We went in on that day with the money, fully intending. We had a meeting the night before with the bank. Everything was in order, ready to buy the ship, and walked in, and we're in this, remember, this is very sort of palatial, very fancy waiting room. And this guy that we've been working with for, this was 10 days, 2 weeks. You know, we've been working with this guy constantly, working out the details. And he walked in. We were sitting there. He walked in, stood in front of us, and said, "Gentlemen, I'm sorry to inform you that the ship has been sold." And he turned around and walked away. Now, I am on my feet yelling at him at this point, right? You know, yelling at the guy. Who bought it? What's going on here, right? Not talking, right? You're not going to say a word. We knew somebody else at the bank that we've been dealing with who was a little bit higher up than that guy, and then I went screaming in his office. Same deal. They're not talking about it. Ship has been sold. Sorry. Too little, too late. So we're out, right?
We're done.
No, but we found out. So we then find out the guy who bought it was a sailmaker in London who had made the sales for the ship 2 years before.
Oh, so he associated with the guy?
He was a straw man. This was money, black money, coming from Papa Blanca. They wanted to keep the ship. They had to have, but they couldn't do it or claim anything. So what they did was they bought it. They paid off the minimum amount through a straw man, this guy in England, the sailmaker. It was all illegal deal. It was all black money. None of the money was his, right? This is some Joe Bag of Donuts sailmaker. This isn't some big fancy company guy with a lot of money. This is a hole in the wall, right? This is a sail loft. This is some guy making sales.
How much did they pay for it?
By hand. Pardon?
How much did they pay for the ship?
I don't know. They wouldn't tell me. They wouldn't divulge, right? So Mike Wheeler and I, in a rage, got on a plane to London and went to see this guy. Because I'm pissed off. I know this is all black money, right? I know that this is all crooked. I know that these are all bad guys, right? Well, where did the sailmaker get the money? So now I'm going to make charges against the sailmaker. You better have paid taxes on this money. You better have this money around. So what happened is I went walking into this guy's office cold. I remember I wasn't drafted over or anything else. I was just a Salem guy then. And went storming into this guy's office. I remember I was told that I'd have to wait, and I said, "Bullshit, I'm not waiting." And the receptionist said, "You know, should I call the police?" Right? Because I went busting in through this guy's door, and he was sitting in this big cluttered office at this enormous desk, right, that was covered with papers and everything. And I started yelling at this guy, "Are you the son of a bitch that just thinks he bought Brigantine Phoenix?" Right? "What the hell are you doing in my office?" Right? "I'll call the police." "Call the fucking police!" Right? I'm yelling at this guy. Right? "You know, you think that anybody's not going to look at this transaction? You think you just bought this ship, right? With what cash? Whose cash? It's none of your effing business!" He's screaming at me. And I still remember that he was behind his desk standing up, and I was on the other side of his desk, and he's leaning in, screaming at me, red-faced, "Get out of this. He's going to call the police." I remember screaming, "Call the goddamn police," and I got my hands underneath his desk and flipped this whole desk. It was huge, and it was covered with stuff, and flipped it over, and everything went flying. And this guy starts screaming, "God damn it," you know, and he's screaming, call the police now. And I'm standing, I'm not leaving. I'm standing there, "Call the goddamn police." And so this just got completely out of hand. And so then all of a sudden now all these other guys show up from the sail loft, all these workers and everything. They're all like standing there wondering. And the guy looks over, and says, throw this son of a bitch out, right? And so these guys now are all coming at me, and Mike Wheeler's standing there too. I'm not by myself. Mike Wheeler's standing there with me. He just hasn't said a word, right? So all these guys start walking over like they're going to lay hands on us, right? And Mike Wheeler is enormous. He looks like a bear. He's a giant of a guy with a full black beard and everything else. And at the time, I was big. I'm smaller now. I weighed about 50 pounds more, and I was about an inch and a half taller. I've had surgery now. It cost me an inch and a half of height. I've had a bunch of vertebrae fused and metal rods and all this stuff and broke my back a couple times. So I'm shorter now and much thinner. And I remember looking at these guys all standing there, and they were just workers. These aren't tough guys or anything else. They got an apoplectic boss screaming to throw these guys out. They don't know what to do, right? And I remember I looked at one of them, and one of them was like reaching to take my arm, and I said, don't even think about it. Don't even think about it, right? And we just walked out. And that was the end of it. That was the end of the whole thing. What we subsequently found out is that the sailmaker was a straw man for Papa Blanca, this gangster in Holland. He had dumped in his black money into this ship as well. Now the two owners get screwed up because of these Americans in Sweden, and it hits the newspapers, and a reporter starts digging into it. They get indicted and go to prison. Now Papa Blanca's, all his money in the ship is gone and seized by a bank, and he's furious. He's in a rage. So he's telling these two owners, you make this right, you know. You got your own problems with the government. You got problems with me too, right? Make this right. So the interesting part about the negotiation is that there's a whole thing going on here that we didn't even see. And what was happening is that this was a timing issue. They had to have time to put together the money and figure out what they want to do. They thought they had time when they squashed the auction, right? But then here comes this Joe Bag of Donuts from the United States, right, with a big bunch of cash, right? I remember I came with $280,000, right? And this screwed up all their plans to somehow, you know, to save the equity of the ship. What they were going to do is all along have some straw man buy it for like $35,000, threaten everybody else. That was a plan. Threaten anybody that bids, buy it for a song from the bank, and through some straw man, like the sailmaker in London that nobody knows and he doesn't show up, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody ever sees him. And then he then switches it over back to Papa Blanca, and it's all sort of back together again. That's what was supposed to happen. The whole thing fell apart with Case Tynenberg going to the work camp in the woods, Herr Kramer Frere ending up in Mallorca, right, living on some 50-foot boat in Mallorca and walking away from his plant, basically. And then these Americans blowing up, everything going crazy. What happened in the end was really bad. I guess from my point of view, is that the ship ended up going from Papa Blanca to basically the worst gangster in London.
How do you go to him?
Through some weird sort of deal, it ends up with a guy named Barry. Oh God, I can't think of Barry's last name now. Barry had been an enforcer, a collection guy. He was a knee buster for people who had gambling debts. So he's a guy that would, you know, just, he was just a leg breaker. And somehow he ended up with his name on this ship. And it ended up in Jamaica doing just what I had wanted to do with it. It was part of my business plan to get it to Jamaica. There were no square rig ships in Jamaica. And Barry hired a captain who was a very good friend of mine and had been captain of Phoenix before. And I told him, who knew the whole story and knew everything that happened. He knew everything, my friend, right? And my friend cut a deal with Barry that Barry wasn't going to pay him what a ship's captain should earn, that he would get equity interest in the ship. My friend wanted to buy the ship, but he didn't have the money, right? And so he said, for being captain, you know, in the first year of captain, he would acquire 10% ownership in the ship. In the second year of operation, he would get another 10%. If the ship hit certain money things, then he would get additional 2 and 3%. And he could acquire up to 49% of the ship. That's what he was after. Well, he worked that ship for 2 years. And they made so much money that you couldn't even believe it. It was incredible. What they were doing was charging. There were no other ships or anything
in the pirate area.
Yeah, this was actually sailing out of Montego Bay. And they were right there by one of the hotels. And what they were doing were 6 days a week, 2 day trips. There's a morning trip that left at 10 o'clock and went, and they would serve lunch on board and drinks, right? And then everybody would get in about 2 o'clock or something like that. And there was another one that left at 4 and went to about 7. But they were charging $50 a head, U.S. cash only. The only way you could pay was U.S. dollars, $50 a person, didn't matter your age. Kids, adults, $50 a person. This was for about 3.5 to 4.5 hours on board. But the real kicker was that they were selling Heinekens and hors d'oeuvres. Like, what they fed you for lunch and dinner was really nothing more than hors d'oeuvre type food that they would heat up in the microwave in the oven, and they just kept food coming, right? But it wasn't for free. You got on the ship for the $50, but everything else was a la carte. All the drinks, all the soda pop, the Heinekens, the waters, everything else. And they're doing this twice a day. They're making $8,000 to $9,000 a day in cash 6 days a week. This is 20 years ago. Money is rolling in. There's no taxes or fees. This is entirely unregulated. The government doesn't even really know what's happening. There's no licenses. They didn't bribe anybody. They just showed up in the islands, and they started making $8,000 a day, 6 days a week, all in cash. And my friend was telling me at some points, he said, we didn't know what to do with the money. He said his cabin where he slept was awash in cash. He said it was just stashed everywhere. He said because it was such a pain in the ass to go to the banks, right? He said, and after a couple days, he said, Jesus Christ, he said, after a couple days, he said it was completely out of hand. He said there'd be $50,000 in cash in this cabin, right? And he said it was nuts. So this went on for 2 years. 2 years that they made all this money. And then what happened is the time for the reckoning came, where he was supposed to get his papers signed over for his ownership of the ship. He was also supposed to get, had a cut of the profits, right? Now, he'd been banking all the money, but he was a deposit only. He didn't have access to taking it out, right? He was operating off of, you know, a credit card, so he'd make deposits in the bank, but the credit card wasn't tied to that account. He couldn't just take it all out. Do you know what I mean? So at any rate, what happened is Barry, the gangster, shows up from England 2 years later. And they're going to sign all the papers over. That's what he came for. Take care of you, sign all the papers, and give you your cut of the funds and work out what we're going to do next. Because the Jamaican government at this point realized how much money was involved and started to, first it was bribes that they wanted all the time. And then they came in and they said, no, this all has to be regulated. You have to pass inspections. You have to. So the whole thing was going to collapse anyway. So in comes Barry and flies in first class from England. Nasty gangster, and he took my friend out to the fanciest restaurant in Jamaica, in Montego Bay. It was up on a hill above the city, and it was on a, there was a veranda that looked out, right? It looked right out onto the harbor and the bay and everything. So they're sitting there they had a great dinner, have a couple drinks, and after dinner they're having a drink, and they're going to get down to business, and Barry reaches into his pocket, takes out a plane ticket, and drops it on the table, and says, that's yours. My friend opened it up, and it was a one-way plane ticket to London. That was it. A one-way plane ticket to London. And Barry said, that's it. You're done. You're off the ship. And I said, wait a minute. You know, we have our deal. No, it was no deal. You don't get anything. You're not getting a piece of ship. You're not getting any of the money. Nothing. That's all you get. You either take that plane ticket and fly away and forget about it, or I'll take the plane ticket back and you're just here in Jamaica. And my friend said, bullshit, I'll take the ship, right? You know, I'll take the damn ship. You can't do this. And Barry looked back at him and said, ship's gone. Ship's gone. They were inside the restaurant then, and my friend, the ship was anchored right there in the harbor. My friend went out, and the ship is gone. It's not at anchor anymore. He comes back, and he's in a rage, and Barry is sitting there. And Barry said, yeah, she sailed about half an hour ago. I think you can see her out on the horizon. My friend looked, and yeah, his ship, with all of his belongings, all of his books, his father's sextant, All his everything he owned in life, other than the clothes he had on him, was miles out to sea already, gone. Tried to go to the authorities. Barry flew back to London. Ship left Jamaica and didn't come back. Ship went down further down into the chain and was gone. And my friend was just left high and dry with a plane ticket that he never used in Jamaica. That's it. That's all I know. That was the negotiation. This is all these big negotiations and everything else. The whole reason for all the threats and everything else was just to delay time. We never even realized that. We thought we had all the time in the world so long as we didn't get beaten up. Is that not a... Maybe that's not a good negotiation story, but it was like... Negotiation. Well, there was the negotiation after the first set, the negotiation on Groenhoven. It failed, right? Because the guys thought they were getting the ship and they wanted to charter it out and they wanted to have parties and they wanted a queen on board. What they got was a Class A square rig ship filled with shitty rice, right? Unlivable. So that whole thing failed. The next thing was this negotiations with the bank over this whole thing. We didn't even realize what the issue was, did we? We thought we were dealing with the bank the whole time. How much money did I spend on these negotiations to buy the ship? I mean, a lot of money, a lot of time, right? We didn't even realize what was going on. We didn't even really know any of this stuff was happening until the end almost, right? We didn't know in Groenhoven that these guys were criminals and black money, and this was a big story in Amsterdam. We knew it was a big story in Sweden. We didn't have any idea this was going on in Amsterdam and Rotterdam in the papers. We had no idea. All of this is going on in the background. We're doing all this research. We think we're smart. I think I'm a negotiator. We got all this money, right? And what happened? We don't even really know what's going on. In Groenhoven, we didn't know what was happening, there. When we came back to buy the ship, I had Freddie Charles, who lived there in Rotterdam. She's reading the papers. She should have known what's going on, right? I mean, it was the bankers never really told us anything about Papa Blanca. It wasn't until the reporter told us about Papa Blanca. Aren't you worried about Papa Blanca? We said, never heard of him. He said, didn't the bank talk to you about Papa Blanca? We said, no. That's when we went back in the next day, and the banker said, oh, well, yeah. And that's in the book then that he didn't show us. All these articles of Papa Blanca's name is mentioned, all highlighted Papa Blanca all the way through. This is one of these negotiations where we thought we knew what we were doing. We thought we knew the subject matter cold. We didn't have a clue what was going on in the back. We just didn't have a clue. This is a negotiation doomed to failure from the beginning. And it, because it was really sexy things, square rig ships, Europe, lots of money, all this intrigue, guns and German shepherds, at midnight, right? Death threats at an auction, for God's sakes. This is all a true story. This is all a true story. I mean, there's a lot more to it. I mean, when I left out lots of stuff, but it's late and I gotta go.
Yeah.
I
still have to go.
Overall, like the entire negotiation from your own, what you're trying to do, from what the Papa guy, what was his name again?
Papa Blanca.
What he's trying to do. You don't have all this information, and that's why you're thinking you're going to...
We're involved in a situation that we thought we understood completely, because we rigged the ship. You know what we were doing? You know what our time was focused on? Our time was focused on the offers that we were going to make to the bank, how we were avoid getting our legs busted out from under us, and this buying spree of all the shit. You know, it was weird that when we were getting together and we were in bars, we're not talking about all this. We thought we knew it cold what was going on. You know what we were doing? We're writing lists of the food that we want to take with us when we leave. That's what we were doing. We were writing lists of what we wanted to eat, for God's sakes, once we got on board and started sailing. We were doing lists.
So you were confident that the negotiation was...
We thought we were completely controlled. The day I went to that bank, the only time I was there in the daylight is when we were going to sign the papers and buy it, and it was all done. And that's the day I was told, ship's sold. Ship's been sold. Right?
That was there any way for you to have rushed the negotiation, you think? Because the guys were keeping you at night. They never gave you the time of day to sign the paper during the day.
No. I don't know how we could have done it. I think that was a doomed one from the beginning.
I mean, you didn't know the whole time delay was working against you.
We didn't know. Well, when I flew over there, we certainly didn't know there was going to be, get busted up threats or sink the ship. That's the other one, sink the ship. What we were told is they were going
to
sink the ship in the lock.
You had to get it out of the lock.
Well, the other thing is it said Well, they're not going to really damage the ship. They just want something that's... And I should have known what was going on because I was specifically told. They're not going to... They want the ship. The ship's valuable. They're not going to destroy the ship. But they'll punch a hole in it so you can't take it out to sea. They don't mind if it settles down on the bottom in, you know, in 10 feet or in 6 feet. Because all you do is just put somebody down, put a patch on it, pump the thing out, and, you know, in 6 hours it's floating again. That's all they're going to do. They're going to do something so that we couldn't leave... That we would have difficulty getting it out, but they wouldn't. We were oblivious to all of it. Right? I should have given you some cool business one, but you asked for something interesting.
No,
and this was a series of negotiations that took place over a long period of time, you know, sort of endless. And the one thing that sort of defines the whole thing, all of it, is we never knew what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, we never had any idea. There is a book on square-rigged ships that has Brigantine Phoenix in it. There's a beautiful picture of it. And in the liner notes, it talks about this story.
Ah.
Talks about it. And it talks about the fact that Kerr Kramer Fair was convicted of black money and ended up going to a work camp.
Huh.
Was this too dumb?
No, it's interesting.
It's a failed negotiation where you have people who know the subject matter cold, but don't see the bigger picture because they're so focused on the details, right? We should have known. Well, we should have known the minute that that auction, something's wrong. We're a $500,000 ship. Now, $500,000 to us, right? I mean, understand, my, the purchase price to me from the bank was, I mean, that was, I think it was $158,000, actually, I think is what we were paying for, $158,000. Not including transfer taxes or the legal fees or anything else.
It's highly possible that that straw man outbid it in that short time. But I'm surprised that they could have gotten the paperwork and all the other stuff done.
Sold. Yeah, sold. How did all that happen?
It was happening maybe behind. Yeah.
They got to somebody at the bank.
Yeah.
I mean, we came to that conclusion as well. They just, and I don't think they either threatened them or paid them off or something like that. But this is Papa Blanca. This is one of the biggest gangsters in Holland. Can't tell me you can't get to a banker, you know, and say, we'll get you the money, right, but do it to these guys and do it that way or you'll be in trouble, right?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that happens. And people believe that in Holland because the gangsters in Holland, people don't realize it, but there's a pretty serious... criminals in Holland. That's, the Holland's a tough place.
Yeah.
Holland's a tough place.
I've actually seen a movie.
So this is, of course, a goofy story about getting square rigged ships and getting charged with piracy and banging around in Europe and you know the Baltic being searched. But with this theme of these big negotiations that went through, the first negotiation was I'm negotiating with the owners that we get the ship for 3 months, and they didn't know what they were doing, did they?
Yeah.
The whole thing went sideways because they didn't know what they negotiated away until after it was done, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then all their friends, they see the ship up with all the stuff. Then all their friends start gabbing at them how much this is worth. And then it dawns on them, wait a minute. We could have had this rig for $350,000 and then chartered her out for $500,000 over this time. We would have made money and had a good time. We didn't know any of this. They're thinking they got cheated somehow, right?
Yeah.
Right? And so because they thought they got an unfair deal in the beginning, they figured it's what? Unstable, as we talked about. Unstable agreement. What are they going to do? They did the only thing they could do to breach it, right? They think they're going to throw us off because they're more powerful because we're Americans and we're in Europe. We have no resources. Right? And they thought we'd just go away quietly. Well, they underestimated that. They didn't know I'd been living in Europe for 10 years. I had friends everywhere then, right? I wasn't like some goofy American kid. So what happened is that they think they're getting the ship, and what happened? We got a shitty deal, didn't we? Paid off, you know, the $100,000 at the end in Groenhoven, right? So that was unstable too, wasn't it? Because what happened is that my crew cut the headlines and filled the thing with shit. So they didn't get what they wanted, right?
Why didn't you guys not agree to the negotiations for $100,000?
Because they would have had to get off the ship right then and there. That was the thing. You gave them a choice. You get 2 weeks and this money.
I thought the ship was going to Stockholm.
No, they got 2 weeks to go around wherever they want and then drop wherever they end up at the week.
No, I think you're talking about at the end.
Yeah, when
the
you made
police
the
there.
For the
and the police are saying you got 48 hours, right?
Right.
Right. What the police had told us is that You have 48 hours, and if you don't come into agreement, the first thing that happens is everybody that's currently on this ship is off, right? We as the police are not going to say that you get to stay on this ship. They're clearly owners. They can tell you to be off, and you're off, right? You may have a civil claim against them for doing it, right? But it's not criminal for them to order anybody off their ship, right? So we're telling you you have a 48-hour window because you're living on it and your stuff on it. We'll protect it. We'll guard the docks, right? They're not allowed on board. The owners were not allowed to set foot on board. We weren't allowed to set foot off. Now, I got to go off to do this negotiation. The police escorted me there. This little, it's like a patio thing where they sold fruit juice, and it was in the sun in Groenhogen. It was one of those goofy Cinzano umbrellas, right?
Yeah.
And the three of us sat there. These two, Kerr Kramer Fair, the two guys, the one guy who fled and the guy who went to jail, those two guys sat with me that whole time. For 2 days, that went on, right? Why didn't I just look back and say, take us, we'll do it? That's because what was happening then was the police were going to throw us. We got 15 guys living on the ship, right? We have friends, but we don't have cars, right? We don't have any money, right? I mean, we all have money. We're all actually, we had, it was actually kind of a wealthy bunch of people, but nobody has it there, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
principle, you know, too. You want something for everything you get.
But we weren't prepared to get dumped off the ship in Groenhogen in the middle of nowhere, have to work our way, or have to get to Stockholm, and then be in Stockholm for the next 2 weeks during the course of these proceedings, right? And not knowing what was going to happen or anything else. And the other thing was that an attorney showed up out of a Rolls Royce. He carried a Rolls Royce over. We got screwed by this by our own attorney, not somebody I hired, somebody a friend of mine hired on our behalf. But no, there was a decision made. I didn't agree to it. What happened is the final offer was whatever they brought, this bag of cash. They brought this bag of cash, the owners, from Amsterdam. And it was just under $100,000. It was the most cash they could get in about 3 hours that they had to come. They got a call that said, come here now. And they hired a private plane. The private plane actually landed on the water at this goofy little place in Groenhoven. That's how they came in, this little plane with pontoons on it, with a big bag of cash. Right, so that's how this all kind of happened. But what's weird is everything we thought was wrong all the way down the line, and everybody involved in this, although we're really smart guys, were wrong. Oh, geez, can you hold on 1 second? This is my daughter.
I have to take
my daughter. Hi, honey. Can I call you back in 10 minutes? Okay. I'll call you back in 10 minutes. See you, bye. It's my daughter. She's away at boarding school out east.
The one that was in class with us? Or no? You have two daughters?
Yeah, I do, two. I don't know which one was in class. Oh, that was Diana. That's her. Yeah, she's away. She goes to school in New Hampshire. Her choice, not mine.
Okay. No, you brought in one of them first day of class.
Oh, yeah. That was my daughter, Diana. She's the one who left. She left right after that to go to out east. Yeah. She goes to some fancy school out there that she's in love with. She's in love with her high school. It's high school, for God's sake.
Yeah, that's good.
Her decision.
You know, when you're telling us...
Is this too dumb a story to talk about negotiations?
This will definitely work. We've got a lot of material to talk about.
To think about the bigger picture of what the real bigger negotiation was, and I'm thinking about how just... focusing on something when you have it all down, you know what you're doing, and you miss. I mean, there's no way
everything.
You could have predicted
that. I mean, I missed everything. We missed everything.
There's no way you could have predicted that either. And
we were so what strikes me is we were, you can't imagine how fired up we were during this period. I mean, we were so excited. We were almost walking on cloud nine all the time. I mean, we were completely geeked up all the time. We were like little kids. We were so excited about getting the ship. We didn't even know what was going on.
Yeah,
didn't have any idea what was going on.
So your emotion was probably involved, like half of the factors.
We thought none of the people we were dealing with knew anything about these ships. Nobody that we were dealing with knew anything about these ships. We were the experts in the subject matter because he was a ship's captain, I was a ship's first officer. We both sailed this ship for years. That ship, we knew it cold.
Mm-hmm.
So we think we're the experts. We know what it's worth. We know what to do with it. They don't know. Nobody else knows. Right? We can actually sail it. They can't. Right? We just thought everything was going for us. had a big bag of money. How can this go wrong? We didn't have any idea what we were dealing with at any point ever in any of this negotiation. We didn't know there was a big hue and cry in Amsterdam. We had no idea. We had no idea. I mean, I didn't even know that Kramer Frayer and Case Tynenberg were indicted. None of this. I don't know any of this stuff.
You know, you're telling us the story, the part of it where you're walking down the street and those two guys start showing up. I thought you were about to tell me the same thing you told us about the going crazy part.
Oh. No, there's no craziness. Okay. Nobody believed that story in class, and that's all juiced up.